Today, the monetary arms race is here. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, this post covering finance and broader news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, Phil Lowe appeared before the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics. He was at pains to highlight the need to snuff inflation out before it gets embedded, and that short-term pain for households and businesses was a trade-off worth making for the longer-term gain.
It is important that we avoid a cycle where higher inflation leads to higher wages and inflation remaining high. This type of cycle would lead to higher interest rates, a weaker economy, and higher unemployment. Businesses too have a role in avoiding these damaging outcomes by not using the higher inflation as a cover for an increase in their profit margins. A third issue that we're watching carefully is household spending. Consumer sentiment has fallen recently, household disposable incomes under pressure from higher inflation and higher interest rates, and housing prices are declining after the earlier large gains. On the other hand, many households are benefiting from the strong labour market, including by finding jobs and getting more hours of work. And some households are also continuing to save at a higher rate than before the pandemic, and quite a few have built up large financial buffers over the past couple of years, although many other households have very limited financial buffers. In the face of these competing factors, the recent data suggests that household spending has remained resilient so far. Again, that's good news. There is, though, considerable uncertainty as to how these various factors will balance out over the months ahead, and we're watching the situation very carefully. In terms of the outlook for interest rates, the Reserve Bank Board expects that further increases will be required to bring inflation back to target. We're not on a preset path, though, especially given the uncertainties that I've just spoken about. The increase in interest rates has been rapid and it's been global. And we know that monetary policy operates with a lag. At some point, it will be appropriate to slow the rate of increase in interest rates, and the case for doing that becomes stronger as the level of interest rates increases. But as I said previously, the size and the timing of future interest rate increases will be guided by the incoming data and the board's assessment of the outlook for inflation and the labour market.
And Lowe said he would not be surprised if national house prices fell an average of 10%, and while the RBA does not have forecasts of housing prices, there was a possibility that housing prices could drop, especially after a huge rise during the pandemic. It's hard to forecast asset prices, and prices went up 25% over the past 2 years, a very, very big increase. Lowe said it would not surprise me, and this is not a forecast, but it would not surprise me if prices came down by 10%, or even if they did, they're still up 15% over 3 years. And Lowe said interest rates would only drop back to near zero levels if Australia experienced another sharp downturn.
With regard to, you know, where interest rates have been in recent times and these, and we're seeing the rate rises now, what's a reasonable view? Will they be returning to these sort of periods? Should people have that expectation? It seems there's a strong, you know, pushback against interest rates rising, but realistically, where are they rising to? Is this a more of a normalised setting? Can we expect them? Should people be expecting them to be returning lower?
Well, I hope they don't return lower, because that would mean the economy's weak. It's a good question, but it's a difficult one. But I think what I can say is the midpoint of our inflation target at the moment is 2.5%. So if inflation averages over the next 10 years 2.5%, you would expect that the cash rate at average is at least 2.5% as well. If it didn't, then on average you'd have a negative real rate and the risk-free rate wouldn't be compensating people for inflation. That would only happen if productivity growth was weak and the economy was weak. So the interest rate should at least average the midpoint of the inflation target. I suspect it should average higher than that, because if there's productivity growth in the economy, that should lead to a higher real interest rate. If we can generate 1% labour productivity growth, which I hope we can, then you would expect the average interest rates over long periods of time to be equal to the inflation rate plus the rate of growth of productivity. So that would be kind of averaging an interest rate of 3% possible. And we would see movements around that with the economic cycle. And we would only see rates come back down to close to zero if we had a sharp downturn again. But I think we'll cycle around some number between 2.5 and 3.5. It's hard to be specific. And we'll cycle up and down that with the economic cycle. And so we're closer now to that, aren't we? We're at 2.35. So we're kind of getting to kind of that range that you'd think is normal, but probably still on the low side.
And maybe this is a follow-on, but your comments in your opening address there around the 2020, a dire outlook ahead. How would you describe our outlook now?
I would say uncertain, but still positive. We're expecting growth in the economy to be reasonably good next year. Some modest lift in the unemployment rate, but if we keep perspective, for the past 50 years, if we'd had an unemployment rate of 4%, people would say fantastic. Underemployment is low, people are getting jobs, they're getting the hours, female labour force participation's at a record high. The youth unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in many, many decades. So even if the unemployment rate comes up to 4% from 3.5, those things will all still be true. So that's, we've got to remember that. The Australian economy for the last 30 or 40 years has done remarkably well, but I've always thought that one black spot in our economy was that people couldn't get the jobs and the hours that they wanted. We'd struggle to get to full employment. And we're as close to full employment now. We've been in 50 years. So that's fantastic news for people, because getting a job and getting an education are the two kind of critical steps on the ladder of success for most people. And most people in the country can get a job today, and the number of job vacancies is very high. So I think over the next little while, we're expecting the unemployment rate to come down further and then gradually lift it. So kind of the outlook for the labour market is strong, and it's as strong as it's been in decades. That's really good news. The uncertainties really largely become from the global economy, which we've talked about those. And the other thing that I had been concerned about was the possibility of the inflation psychology shifting. Mm-hmm. That this period of higher inflation we're having, where inflation is going to go to 7% plus later in the year, that the view would take hold that wages need to be fully compensated for that. If that were to happen, as I said, we'll have a very difficult time. I don't think it's going to happen. And at the moment, wages are not driving inflation, and the aggregate growth of wages is consistent with inflation returning to target. But whether that stays the case is an uncertainty, because the labour market's really tight, isn't it? And firms are finding it hard to get workers, and wage growth is picking up as a result of that. So I know it's a difficult message, but if wage growth picks up to compensate people for full inflation, we'll have a lot of trouble. I'm hopeful that we don't. In the US and the UK, wage growth is picking up to compensate people for inflation, and that's one reason they're going to have trouble. I hope we can avoid that. So,
and he explained the interest rate lever was the central bank's weapon of choice, and the other levers used in the pandemic crisis was not now relevant. Interbank futures, by the way, are fully pricing in a 0.5% increase in the RBA cash rate next month, and implies a 50-50 chance of an outsized 0.5% move. And ANZ senior economist Catherine Birch said an overall solid labour market report adds to the case made by the strong business survey and US CPI data earlier this week for the RBA to hike the cash rate by 0.5% in October. And Goldman Sachs is also forecasting a 0.5% rate rise, which will be the fifth consecutive move of such a magnitude. But this all begs the question, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then does everything look like a nail? Problem, of course, that many central banks are now considering. And the mother lode is, of course, the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve sets interest rates for the US, but actually, effectively, also sets them for the entire world, given the fact that the US dollar behaves as the reserve currency. Persistently high inflation in the US and elsewhere has forced the Federal Reserve to aggressively raise interest rates, given the dollar a significant yield advantage that has triggered a rampaging rally against its major global peers. The latest US consumer price inflation report for August has dashed hopes that the Fed will be slowing its rate hike cycle. No Fed pivot here. In fact, the US Federal Reserve and its chair, Jerome Powell, will now be feeling justified in taking even bigger steps with interest rates to tamp down inflation. The latest market indicators are that US rates will be rising above 4% and stay there for some time, and they will also continue to reverse the quantitative easing from recent years, so things are going to get tight. The US 30-year mortgage rate has already risen to above 6%, that's the highest since 2008, and of course the housing market in the US is easing. The core problem that face feds is wages in the US are rising, and embedded inflation into the system is now happening in a structural way, and they said that the American labour market is unsustainably tight, so higher rates are required to choke demand, lift unemployment, and drive inflation lower. The single tool, of course, is setting interest rates. But the question is, could they be hampered by just a myopia that this is the only tool they've got? We must lift rates until inflation falls, they say. And here is the problem. Much of the current global inflation wave is actually being driven by external supply side issues as supply chains were disrupted. And indeed, you could argue the world has changed fundamentally since COVID struck in 2020 and globalization reversed to a significant degree. Plus, of course, central banks flooded economies and markets with all but unlimited cheap funds. Neither of those issues would be directly addressed by lifting rates. And even if the strategy is appropriate for the US economy, and that is questionable in the first place, despite it being the Fed's ambit of responsibility, the truth is not every economy needs even higher borrowing costs to choke off demand. We're seeing signs of what could be called a monetary arms race as the Fed lifts rates higher to try to choke off inflation, and other economies have to follow suit, even if their economies are differently placed. Now, to me, the Fed and other central banks remain locked into that rate hike myopia. If the Fed does raise rates with a vengeance, the effects will be felt outside of its national purview. Parts of the global economy will break. The worldwide downturn will in turn blow back into US growth, and so then we'll be headlong into the realm of unintended consequences. And it's worth noting, of course, the US dollar is immensely strong just now, and this translates into weaker exchange rates into other currencies. While headline inflation is likely to drop sharply next year, anyway due to base effects, dragging the world back to much lower core inflation, excluding food and energy, is going to come at a huge economic cost. Global bond markets follow where the US Treasury yield goes, and their trajectory is terrifying for economies and currencies that can't match the rates. This time last year, the yields were at 0.2%, and now they are, well, nearly 19 times higher. And all this is before the Fed's full-throttle $95 billion per month quantitative tightening kicks in. It really hasn't had time to assess the effects of the rapid hiking it's had so far. But, like it or not, the dollar is the world's reserve currency. Everyone outside the US will feel the impact if liquidity dries up with higher rates. US investors, of course, will continue to have no incentive to stray from American assets, and this will starve the rest of the world of capital. The latest Bank of America Worldwide Survey of Fund Managers, released on Tuesday, shows the largest underweight of global equities in its history. So if you're a professional investment strategist, you're not going to be fired if you stick to dollar assets or just dollar cash. It's hard to see what will change that mindset. And it's mighty tough for other economies and markets to compete when all roads lead to a stronger dollar. That omnipotence is laying waste to many of the world's currencies, as the Fed's swift interest rate increases compel faster and faster flights to quality. Let's take Japan as an example. The yen is at its lowest since 1990, with a more than 25% weakening against the dollar in the past year. The country has seen its export-led economic advantage over the US rent asunder because of the need to import most of its energy and pay for it in the dollars. The Bank of Japan has been forced to step up its defense of the currency. Active intervention is now a distinct possibility, funding it probably with sales of its reserves of US Treasury bonds. Japan's efforts to stop the yen's sharp fall through unilateral market intervention would only have a limited impact, though a senior member of the country's ruling party warned, as data showed that the currency's recent tumble blew the trade gap out to a record. The ruling Liberal Democrat Party's head of Research Commission on Financial Affairs said Tokyo lacks effective means to combat the yen's falls and that unilateral interventions would be limited. Solo currency interventions won't be that effective in stemming sharp yen falls, which are driven by the interest rate gap between the United States and Japan. The Bank of Japan on Wednesday conducted a rate check with banks in apparent preparation to step in to reduce the yen's falls, which sent it up more than 1% and highlighted its nervousness about steep declines. For a long time, the Bank of Japan was the sole major central bank happy to pursue inflation as a path to growth for its stagnant economy. It's finally seeing prints above its 2% target. Simultaneously, it maintained an iron grip on its bond market to keep interest rates low, often negative. But it cannot do both of these things and prevent its currency from spiraling downwards. There are limits to how far or fast it can let the yen fall. And this will have the knock-on effect on the Chinese yuan, the Korean won, and the Taiwan dollar. Another bout of dollar strength, juiced by a fresh rate surge from the Fed, could blow the Bank of Japan's strategy apart and upset the rest of Asia. China, meanwhile, will feel entitled to respond in kind to an unwanted decline in its currency. It normally keeps it carefully under control, but it has had to let the yuan weaken by over 10% to the dollar in the past 6 months. Not even the world's second largest currency can withstand the American inflationary tide. And in Europe, both the euro and the pound have been racing each other lower versus the dollar since the spring of last year. Already hamstrung by all the spending to exit the pandemic, Europe is now caught in the crosshairs of the energy crisis because of its dependence on Russian natural gas. Growth is evaporating before our eyes, with the UK flatlining all this year and parts of the European Union sliding into recession. Deutsche Bank analysts expect the German economy to contract by as much as 4% next year. And like the Fed, the European Central Bank and the Bank of England are contemplating not just beggar thy neighbour jumbo rate hikes, but also reducing banking system liquidity and reversive quantitative easing bond purchases all at once. Emerging markets are being badly impacted too, as many international transactions and commodities are transacted in US dollars. In Australia, the RBA is saying rates need to rise despite wages growth being much lower than the US. And in today's House of Representatives testimony, Lowe suggested that rates are likely to be centred in, say, 3%. Higher rates will crimp demand, but if they're wrong, interest rates will be higher. Stopping and restarting the global economy requires greater flexibility than offered by the blunt instrument of interest rates. It's a good thing to wean financial markets and asset prices off repeated bouts of quantitative easing, but unwinding it's something the Fed has failed to get right, actually twice. Why do central banks persist in trying to land vast economies on the head of a 2% inflation target pin when it's no longer either feasible or desirable? So surely it's time for a flexible range rather than the precise number. Eventually, the Fed's actions will come back to bite it and the US. But by then, all the many trillions of dollars of stimulus work done during the pandemic will have been unwound, which will be a phenomenal waste of time, money and effort. The fallout on the Fed's myopia will be felt more in other countries, including Australia, which means we're on the end of the seesaw, actually the wrong end of the seesaw, driven by the US. This is soft power at its worst, transmitted to a monetary system which is built to favour one nation over the rest. The question is, of course, whether this will change. Well, without major reform, it will not, at least in recognition of the fact that many international institutions, such as the IMF, the World Economic Forum, and the BIS, are strongly aligned to the interests of the US. So the monetary arms race is here, and we can't do much about it. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high. Price discovery and price transparency are hard to find. And then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot
Ruben an email at info@rubenproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer.
I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.